to your own health and fitness. I'm Health Integration Specialist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss self-care and integrated health. You, the health consumer, may be confused by the numerous books on the market written by prominent, prestigiously degreed researchers and doctors promoting completely different, conflicting information on weight loss and prevention of heart disease. Many tell you to eat limited amounts of fat, some say no fat to speak of, and promote the consumption of lots of complex carbohydrates, where others will tell you to eat as much fat and protein as you like. So we're left with the conclusion that we're all being manipulated, or that the way individuals metabolize their dietary fats and carbohydrates depends on some complex variables. Today I'm honored to have with me in studio Dr. Gerald Reaven, discoverer of insulin resistance, which is termed Syndrome X. His studies concerning insulin and heart disease date back 30 years, actually 40 years almost, 40 years, yeah. Join us in this hour as we explore the role of insulin resistance in heart disease. So, welcome to you.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoy the chance of being here and interacting with you and interacting with and having a chance to hopefully educate your listeners.
We're going
to
give it a try. Dr. Gerald Reaven, M.D., is professor emeritus. He's an active professor of medicine at Stanford. You know, this picture doesn't do you justice. You're much, much more handsome.
That's what I thought. It's a serious picture.
Seriously. You're much, much better looking. Of medicine at Stanford University initiated the series of studies leading to his discovery of Syndrome X. A world-renowned endocrinologist, he has served as the director of the Division of Endocrinology and Metabolism, the Division of Gerontology, and the Combined Divisions of Endocrinology, Metabolism, you know, that's not easy to
do. It's not worth it.
It's not worth doing, is it? No. Among other posts at Stanford. In other words, he's king at Stanford in endocrinology and metabolism. Dr. Reaven has received a wide array of scientific awards and is the author of over 500 scholarly papers, and the list of journals, of course, are all the top prestigious journals. He's also served as editor-in-chief of the journal Hormone and Metabolic Research and lives in Stanford, California. This book was co-authored with Terry Christian and Barry Fox. But we've got Gerald Reaven. We've got the real deal here. So welcome to you. All right. I want you to explain insulin resistance because I've done it several times, and I can't do it the way you do it. So.
Well, I probably won't do it very well either, but I'll do my best. I think the place to start is with the notion that the ability of insulin to do its job, and it has complex job, but for the moment, let's focus on making sure that the sugar you absorb when you eat carbohydrate gets put into the right cells in a timely fashion. That capacity will differ as much as tenfold from person to person. In the healthy individuals, we've recently published a paper based upon measuring insulin resistance in about 400 people. And it just varies at least tenfold from the most insulin sensitive to the most insulin resistant. So the first point is the ability of insulin to do its job varies enormously in the healthy, apparently healthy population at large. Now, if you ask the question, why aren't these people diabetic? Why doesn't their blood sugar go up? It's because they will secrete enough insulin to overcome that resistance and therefore compensate for the insulin resistance. Now, an obvious question is, well, if it varies that much, why? You know, how come? And it's impossible to answer that question that so specifically, but roughly, 25% of the variability from person to person is due to differences in how much they weigh. About 25% is due to differences in how fit they are. And people have really underestimated how important physical fitness is. Mm-hmm. The more fit you are, the more insulin sensitive you are. The other half is probably, because when I say probably genetic, is because we don't have the genes. And we know it's going to be more than one gene. But we know it's familial. And so it's almost certainly half of the difference is due to variation to genetic composition. One last statement, then I'll shut up for a moment, is that if you ask then, in the genetic world, what do we know? Since we don't know the genes, we do know that there are very powerful ethnic differences, mm-hmm. which seem to be unrelated to either how heavy or how fit or unfit. And by and large, and this is a generalization, by and large, individuals of European ancestry are the most insulin-sensitive groups.
Yeah, although what's happened in this country is that the dietary industry has been pushing high-carbohydrate diets, low-fat diets for a while, and I think that the European population now has become quite insulin-resistant just from dietary and overweight.
Overweight, yes. Diet changes in macronutrient content don't really affect how insulin-resistant you are. And there are much in the way of published data that's showing that fairly broad differences in relative amounts of protein, fat, and carbohydrate do not affect how resistant you are. On the other hand, it's very important if you are insulin resistant what you are eating, carbohydrate, protein, or fat. And I think you're right that we're getting more obese. I think it's because we've been so focused on low-fat diets
yes.
that people think if it says low-fat, yeah. they can eat as much as they want.
Well, let's roll it back for a second because this idea, when we talk about what insulin's job is, people, I think, despite the fact that I've talked about this on the air a lot, people don't realize that part of the job of insulin is to help you store fat. I mean, it's part of the way that, as you say, glucose is driven into the cells. But it's also a fat storage mechanism, is it not? Is that a wrong way to think of it?
Well, I wouldn't put it that way.
Okay.
Because if it has an effect on the fat cell, which it clearly has, it's really to inhibit the breakdown of the stored fat, but that process is incredibly sensitive to very, very small amounts of insulin. So you cannot get too much fat into your fat cells because you have lots of insulin. Insulin regulates the fat storage and fat breakdown. The classic example of this is the so-called type 1 diabetic who has no insulin at all, and all the stored fat is broken down for energy mm-hmm. in those individuals. So, yes, it clearly regulates adipose tissue metabolism.
The other thing that people don't realize is how much insulin's job has to do with making it possible for you to move around and exercise, how it drives sugar into the muscle cells so that you can move around. Again, I didn't say that in a scientific way.
Well,
for you. You're smiling.
Well, I guess I would. Again, I don't.
No. The reason you're here is to give us the scientific
view. I teach physiology, so
yeah,
hopefully
please,
I know
us.
Something. Fundamentally, huh? What's really interesting is that exercise. Let's look at the trained person who is really fit. That person is incredibly insulin sensitive for two reasons. The first reason is the more fit they are, there is an accumulation of a very important molecule called the glucose transporter protein number 4, which are called GLUT4 by the researchers, which is inside the cell, and it has to move to the edge of the cell in order for glucose to come in under the effect of insulin. That is increased in people who are fit. But more importantly, mm-hmm. or equally importantly, exercising muscle will increase its transport of glucose independent of insulin. So an exercising muscle will take up more glucose than will a sedentary muscle in the absence or without any change in insulin concentration.
No, that's very interesting. But it also reaffirms something that I've always felt, because I was an exercise trainer years ago. Which is that when you talk about training the body, you're not just training the body to do an activity, you're training the metabolism, in a sense, to use fuel more effectively.
Yeah, actually, there's something even more interesting in mm-hmm. a certain sense, as long as we're off in this direction, mm-hmm. is that the insulin-secreting cells of the insulin-resistant individual, for reasons not clear, will fire off and put out insulin very aggressively when it sees glucose coming in, more so than the average person. So there's a hypersensitive response. Mm-hmm. The trained athlete, because they are so insulin sensitive and put out usually very small amounts of insulin to transport glucose, that they actually mm-hmm. have almost, if you really hit them with a big bolus uh-huh. of glucose, will almost act like you're diabetic the first time they see it because the pancreas is adapted.
Oh, that's very interesting. Okay, so then my theory, which I see now is wrong, that you can take a normal person who is not excessively sensitive to glucose and sugar and carbohydrates and feed them tons and tons of carbohydrates and sugars, and they get obese, and the fat cells are rejecting the fat, and there's this sort of thing going on. And that, in fact, that constant feeding of carbohydrates, raising the insulin level so that you have a hyperinsulinemia, is not the same as insulin resistance. Is that what we're saying, that you can't become insulin resistant by having a hyperinsulinemia from your diet?
Let's put another way around. That attempts to measure insulin-mediated glucose disposal directly with appropriate techniques have not been able to show that variations in the relative amount of macronutrients, mm-hmm. protein, carbohydrate, mm-hmm. and fat, can substantially modify insulin action. As a matter of fact, there are some individuals who have published papers saying that if anything, a high, that the other way around makes you more sensitive, a high carbohydrate diet. I think that's not true, but that be that as it may. But I think the vast majority of work would say being insulin resistant or insulin sensitive will vary how you respond to differences in your dietary intake, mm-hmm. but the dietary intake per se will not make you more resistant, mm-hmm. unless you gain weight. Now, okay. if you happen to be insulin resistant and you gain weight, you'll get worse. It doesn't matter if you gain weight eating A, B, or C.
Okay, so I think what I just understood, if I can unpack it, is that to talk clinically about insulin resistance, we're talking about a group of people with a specific range of response, metabolic responses, that looks to be genetic. I mean, we talk about the thrifty...
About 50%
of it. So we're talking about people with, you've heard the term thrifty gene.
I think it's actually used incorrectly.
Incorrectly.
But I do believe in the thrifty
yeah.
genotype.
Well, you're talking about these old, you know, you're talking about Native Americans, Pacific Islanders.
But the assumption is, in all these studies, uh-huh. is that the thrifty gene is disposing of fat more efficiently, having insulin-sensitive tissues, and having a very rapid response to insulin. Those are precisely the things that would not predict getting diabetes. Actually, I wrote an interesting paper speculating about that. But if you ask what mm-hmm. are the characteristics of the pre-diabetic, they are exactly the opposite of what the promulgators who use the phrase thrifty gene loosely imply, and it's really misnomer, and I'd be happy to send you a report.
Oh, I love getting studies. Well, you can see I've got piles here, some of which he's already rejected because they're animal studies,
well.
Which I agree. No, I agree. okay, so, you know, one of the things that we talked about when we sat down, and I certainly understand this, is that one of the reasons you wanted to write this book is that everybody has gotten on the bandwagon of the term Syndromex, and they've all explained it to push their own dietary recommendations. And what we see, just even from the little back and forth that we've done here, is that it is more complicated, less easy to understand, less predictable than we have thought initially. What we could say, I think, is that there are people who would be considered clinically insulin resistant, and then there are people who are probably, for a variety of other reasons, including maybe lifestyle and diet and stuff and exercise, becoming carbohydrate sensitive to an extent that they're becoming morbidly obese. Can we say that?
No.
No, we can't say that.
No.
Woo!
I think there is very good solid evidence that says that the kinds of calories you eat have essentially no effect on your weight maintenance.
Woo.
We did studies early on many, many, many years ago, when I was just beginning, we're using formula feedings. Individuals, let me go on.
No, I know, I'm sorry. I'm making a face because of the word formula.
Now, we're trying to deal with a serious scientific question.
I understand.
So the first thing we did was use formula feedings. We weren't interested in weight. We wanted to see the relative effects of differences, major differences in fat or carbohydrate intake on plasma triglyceride concentration, a risk factor for coronary heart disease. We found that eating diets, 85% all carbohydrate, 15% protein, or vice versa, all fat, weight was maintained identically.
So it's calories in, calories out.
Calories. Okay. We then did the same thing with weight loss diets,
right,
showing again the ability to lose weight on food was irrelevant as a function of what kind of calories, as long as it was low. And I'll finally finish up. There is a paper from the Rockefeller University reviewing many feeding studies showing that variations in the kind of macronutrient have no fundamental effect on how much you weigh.
Okay. Just if you're just tuning in.
And I apologize for being obstreperous.
Oh, no. You know what? This is like my favorite interview of all times. I mean, this is like a dream come true to be able to. No, I'm serious. I'm not just placating you. This is something that's very important to me. I want to get it sorted out for people, and I want my listeners to have scientific information. I want them to have experiential information. I want them to learn to pay attention to what's going on. I mean, there are clinical things that they can check if they're concerned here, and we'll go over that. But there's also a whole series of events that can occur when people begin to learn to be discerning about what they're reading, so that they can then apply it to themselves and experiment and see what works and what doesn't work, because there's anecdotal evidence of things too. Sure. So it gets very confusing. Anyway, you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm in studio with Gerald Reaven.
Jerry,
thank you. Dr. Jerry.
Only my mother calls me, or mother
really?
Used to call
okay.
me Gerald.
Well, and you're not in trouble right now. So his new book is called Syndrome X, and Dr. Reaven is the discoverer of this trait called Syndrome X, otherwise known as insulin resistance.
Syndrome.
Thank you. And we're sort of going over what it means clinically and anyway, we're going over all this information. Let me just, I don't want to get stuck here because we have a lot to cover.
Actually, can I mention one about that? Because in the book, we go through several what I call dietary myths or dietary fallacies. And one of these is that carbohydrates make you fat. No, calories make you fat. Insulin does not make you fat. I mean, these are two very crucial issues. Insulin alone, insulin's a hormone. Hormone cannot make energy. Insulin cannot make you fat. All that can make you fat is eating more calories than you put out. Now, insulin may do other things, but it cannot make you fat if you don't eat calories.
Why is it then that when type 1 diabetics overdose on insulin, they get fat?
Oh, there's absolutely no question. First of all, let's give a few examples. The most purest example is an individual who has what's called an islet cell tumor. This is pretty rare, but these are individuals whose insulin-secreting cells are acting abnormally. They secrete insulin even when the sugar is low. They get fat to prevent hypoglycemia. If you treat a type 2 diabetic who has that's even easier than type 1. Take a type 2 diabetic who's hyperglycemic, high blood sugar. If you have a high blood sugar, you are losing sugar in the urine. You are losing 100, easily, maybe more calories a day in the urine. Now, frequently these individuals are overweight. Frequently they're told to lose weight. Frequently they don't lose weight. Now, then the doctor starts insulin or some pill, some medicine. The moment you lower the glucose, you stop losing the glucose in your urine. You're no longer losing calories each day. You gain weight in an inevitable fashion because the calories that you're not taking in any less calories. Your diet hasn't changed. You were losing calories in the urine. You have to get heavy. And we have published two papers showing as long as you decrease the caloric intake equal to the caloric loss that was before you treated the patient, no change in weight.
All right. Anecdotal evidence. Can I do anecdotal stuff with you?
You like. I don't care.
You don't care to the extent that you can't hear it?
No. I mean, I don't mind hearing it. I don't believe it.
Okay. Well, what's to believe? Yeah. I want to share with you what I see. As I mentioned to you, I have an educational consulting practice. I don't treat people, but I sometimes say, you might try this. Mm-hmm. You know, here's a body mm-hmm. of evidence. Mm-hmm. Try this. Mm-hmm. My experience is that the issue of what types of calories people take in, mm-hmm. that there are a number of things that may not show up on a clinical, because you have to admit that when you do a clinical study, as you pointed out when Dr. Dean Ornish called in it, you know, on the show that you are, that it depends on how you ask the question when you're doing a clinical study. Now, that said, what I was impressed with reading your book is that your studies are very clean. It's very, you know, there's not, you read some studies and you go, well, wait a minute, look how you set this up. You took Finnish smokers, you gave them synthetic vitamin E, and you didn't give them enough to get a therapeutic effect. So you can set up a study to get the answer you want. Okay, that said, what I see is that there are people who, for a variety of reasons, are extremely carbohydrate sensitive, maybe not in the clinical sense, but certainly in an addictive sense.
I think, can I make a distinction? Because
yes,
I think we're probably
course.
Not arguing.
Good.
In a sense.
Yeah.
What I am saying is I'm ignoring anything about satiety.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a big
I mean,
yeah,
because
issue.
Satiety
yep.
is very hard to measure.
Yes.
And
yes.
studies of satiety have not been very persuasive either here or there. So, and I wouldn't even get near
all
that
right,
field.
Right,
it's so hard.
Right. So that's
I'm talking
okay.
about a situation where you control intake mm-hmm. and output.
Yeah.
Satiety, if person X can eat less calories by changing their composition, of, you know, their macronutrients, terrific.
Yes.
If person Y
yes.
has the other approach, terrific too. I don't care how anybody would lose weight who's
okay.
overweight. Prayer, okay. calories, you know,
okay.
anything.
Okay, so you agree that some people, either because of addictive patterns with starches, because of allergic patterns with starches, because they come from depressive families and
because,
starches,
you
know,
could go on and on and on and, on.
Okay.
and on.
And then you give them a diet that's higher in protein with more fat and use vegetables and you get them to comply because they feel good. Then they eat. What you're saying is they lose okay. But I have seen people up to a point lose. You can take somebody who's starting to become obese and put them on a starch-free diet using vegetables as carbohydrates and using more protein than is in your diet in the book. You know, instead of 2.5 ounces, which is makes most people
yeah.
cry when they see how much that is, you give them 4 or 5 ounces, and you let them have nuts, and you let them have this and this. What I've seen is that you'll get someone to lose a good 30, you know, a large male will lose a good 30 pounds. Of course, they'll bottom out at some point if they continue to eat too much fat. So in that sense, it
too
is...
Too much calories.
Thank you. Okay. No, you're right to make that distinction. No, you are right to make that distinction. I think you are right because I have observed that. You can.
Yeah.
There's a limit. You know, yeah. it's sort of the, oh my God, it's the food that's making yeah. me fat. You know, what a revelation.
If you eat too much,
you get fat. Yeah.
I do think that really the difference between satiety and physiology
okay.
has to be
right.
sort of
well, let's
clearly
not,
enunciated.
Well, let's not get stuck because what your book is about is the connection between the particulars of insulin resistance the sort of pathological things that it causes and the relationship to heart disease.
Absolutely.
So we're going to break in about 5 minutes, but let's take a few seconds here to talk about, a few minutes, to talk about some of the sorts of things that you see that are going to, first of all, how do you predict that somebody might be insulin
yeah.
resistant?
Well, obviously the most direct way, which we do all the time, and anybody can volunteer for our studies at Stanford, but forgetting that, and I'm not kidding, I wasn't asking anybody to come to Stanford. But
oh, you just mentioned that on the air. People will
but,
give them the contact
But you can measure directly. You
okay.
can measure directly. That's hard. I mean, you can measure insulin resistance directly. That takes a couple, 3 hours in a special place. We do it all the time, but you're not going to do that in the average doctor's office. Measuring insulin levels, that correlates pretty closely, the more resistant, the higher the insulin. But the trouble with that is that there are many laboratories using different kinds of values, and no one really knows what's high or what's low, and I think it's not really interpretable. What I believe one should do is look for the downstream untoward manifestations of being insulin resistant and secreting lots of insulin in a compensatory fashion. And what are they? They're easy to measure. There's increase in your plasma triglyceride concentration. Any doctor can measure that.
These are blood fats.
Yeah,
that's
a blood fat.
Different from cholesterol.
It's not from cholesterol. I could describe it, but it's a kind of blood fat. It's the major way you carry your energy around in the body. Most of your energy is carried in triglycerides in your plasma.
Could I dare to say that triglycerides might be an indication of carbohydrate metabolism? No.
Yeah.
Yes? Oh, good.
I mean, they're fat, there's fat metabolism, but the people with the highest triglycerides
uh-huh.
are the ones who are insulin resistant at abnormality to carbohydrate metabolism, secreting insulin to overcome the resistance, therefore triglycerides go up.
Okay.
The second thing that goes up is your so-called good cholesterol. I shouldn't.
Yeah, you know, and you know how I feel about the term good and bad.
Yeah,
because
I think it's terrible.
Honestly, you know, it's too bad that we have to do that. I know we're trying to make it accessible to the audience, but when you say good and bad, it implies that you could get rid of LDL cholesterol.
No, it's very important. So there's a thing called high density lipoprotein cholesterol, HDL cholesterol. HDL cholesterol, the higher HDL is, the less risk of heart attack. So high triglycerides, low HDL, increased risk of heart attack. Now, if you have high triglycerides, you're going to also have an accumulation of what people have called remnant lipoproteins or postprandial lipid. The triglyceride-rich fat in your blood accumulates throughout the day to an excessive degree. That increases the risk of coronary heart disease. If you have a high triglyceride, you're going to have some other things. I don't have to go through them all, but the other two things you should have your physician measure are your blood pressure. Half the patients with hypertension are insulin resistant with syndrome X, and they also could measure, to be really complete, would be your plasma sugar or glucose level 2 hours after a glucose challenge, because people with insulin resistance may not be diabetic, but they have sugar levels which are a little higher than normal. Those are four easy things to measure, and they predict with a high degree of accuracy how insulin resistant you are.
You're saying that a so-called, as if there was such a thing, normal person would have a 2 hour after eating would have pretty close to normal blood sugar, and somebody with insulin resistance would still be hovering at 150 or something?
Fundamentally, the criteria, and all these numbers from the book, but the criteria for diabetes would be a fast, a sugar 2 hours after glucose load above 200 milligram per DL. 140 to 200 people have different names for. Most normal people, insulin-sensitive, healthy people, would have sugar levels below 120 2 hours after a glucose challenge.
We're going to have to break for about 30 seconds. I'm quite sure everybody is riveted, and we'll be back. This is your own Health and Fitness. I have in studio with me Dr. Jerry Reaven from Stanford, the author of Syndrome X, which is the term he developed for insulin resistance, something he's worked very hard on, maintaining a body of clinical research on human beings. We're discussing what it means to be insulin resistant, what that actually means, and how it affects your heart. And we will be back in 30 seconds.
I don't want you, but I hate to lose you. I ought to cross you off my list, but when you come knocking at my door, fate seems to give my heart a twist, and I come running back for more.
Welcome back. This is your own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I have in studio a very live guest, Dr. Jerry Reaven, author of Syndrome X, which is on the bookstore shelves now.
Can I read this for a second? Because there's another Syndrome X book out written by someone who has no credentials. So I would warn your readers, or not warn them, if they want to read the book that I wrote, they better look for my name on it, because they may well end up with a knockoff Syndrome X by someone who has never worked in the field.
You can't, you don't have any proprietary, you don't copyright, you didn't
No, nothing. Apparently... Once I presented the first paper and discussed this at the ADA meeting, American Diabetes Association meeting, it's now common knowledge. I mean, it's not a word. You know, if I never published a paper using it, I might be able to have done something like that. But since that was not my aim in life, never to my mind to worry about that.
It's too bad. Well, this one is published by Simon & Schuster. It's a mostly red and white book. It says Syndrome X, Overcoming the Silent Killer That Can Give You a Heart Attack. And that's what we've been
talking about. And I apologize for the title, but that was the publisher.
No, I'm sure the publisher had a large effect on this book, because I know how you feel about fad diet books, and they've packaged this book so that it's verging on that same tone. And I know that's not you, because I've read your studies. So I think I told you that I've been following your work for a while, and I almost tracked you down at one point to try to get you on the air, but this makes it easier, obviously. So what we're saying is true. One of the things that's really interesting about this conversation is it's really comforting to be able to come up with these theories that are not quite clinical to explain why people are suffering. You know, I get someone in my office who's really, really overweight and out of control with their diet. I change their diet, they get better. And it's really comforting to say, oh, you're insulin resistant and you have hyperinsulinemia and you should just stop eating things that create insulin. To find out that it's more complicated is almost disappointing, but it is a relief to know what the real science is. Now, here's...
In fact, I would say that, as I said earlier, first of all, the difference from person to person is about 25% just being obese. So it's not, you know,
yeah,
that
powerful.
Yeah, a
lot powerful. Of it is that.
And if you look at insulin-resistant people in the world at large, about 25% would be called normal weight by anybody's criteria. So it's not confined
it's
to
not
being
confined.
Obese.
It's not confined. No, it's not. And I think another very important thing to say here is that it's become more and more clear to me as time has gone on, and I've interviewed really remarkable people, that diet is intensely individual, not because scientifically or clinically people respond differently, but because there are people who will thrive on different diets. And, you know, there are some now sort of underground ways of predicting metabolism. There are new tests that people are doing to predict metabolism and things like that, and to test people and stuff. There's also a lot of pseudoscience that's out there that hasn't, you know, the blood type diet, which was based on good research, and then apparently the sun went off on a right turn and started publishing all this stuff without backing it up. And sure enough, people who are on a type O diet, where they're eating less carbohydrates and probably eating less calories as a result, because, as you said, when you eat more protein, you eat more fat, you're more sated, you feel... So there's this whole thing. But then there are people who, in fact, do well on a carbohydrate high diet. You know, you never say, okay, this is all this different stuff. Now,
I'm
the
sorry,
actual...
Can I bring up one? I think one important issue, which I don't want to get lost, and it's go ahead and diet for a second. I think the major reason that this book or the concept of Syndrome X is important is the fact that we have been totally directed to the only cause or the major cause or the primary cause of coronary heart disease, mm-hmm. heart attack, is mm-hmm. having a high LDL cholesterol. And there's absolutely no doubt that a high LDL cholesterol increases risk of heart attack. There's absolutely no question about it. On the other hand, the abnormalities present in patients with insulin resistance, the high triglyceride, low HDL, high this, you know, low PI1, a whole bunch of stuff, are probably as important, if not more important, than having a high LDL. That doesn't mean you throw away all we learn about how important a high LDL is. It means we realize that life is a little more complicated, and we don't ignore other issues that are equally, if not more, important.
Well, as I said, it's much easier to be able to group people into categories and tell them what to do than to look at the enormous number of variables that can occur. I did a show with Matthew Bayon, who wrote a book about small particle LDL.
Small dense LDL.
Well, he calls it small particle LDL.
You know what causes small dense LDL? I didn't mention that.
Okay.
It's Syndrome X.
Well, that's what I suspect, although it's
insulin resistance and high triglycerides
cause
small, dense LDL.
Yeah, well, and sure enough, people with small particle LDL, small...
Well, the jargon is small, dense LDL density particles.
Density LDL is they do very poorly on a low... This is a very interesting study. Do very poorly on a low fat diet. They get worse because their triglycerides go through the roof.
Well, just for a moment of local pride, really this whole small dense LDL as a major risk factor for coronary heart disease linked to triglycerides, etc., was discovered by people in Berkeley, Ron Krause at
mm-hmm.
the
Heart Lab, the Berkeley Heart Lab, who does lots of expensive testing.
And he and
testing.
I have actually collaborated with ones who showed that insulin resistance, small dense LDL, were another one of the risk factors involved with insulin resistance.
Well, and it's one of the things to say in his behalf, Dr. Superko,
Superko,
sorry, is that he has identified some things that he can actually do with blood tests, which is wonderful.
Well, it links with triglycerides almost perfectly.
This is that study about elderly people predicting mortality. This was done with 5,200 people, and the people who had the highest cholesterol levels and the highest LDLs, lived longer. But it does say, I went back through it, that if your triglycerides are high, all bets are off.
The biggest risk factor for coronary heart disease is to have syndrome X plus a high LDL, which is often called combined dyslipidemia. If one really wanted to screen the population and pick the group that was most at risk, it would be that which I say called combined dyslipidemia, high LDL, high TG, low HDL. I'm sorry, high triglyceride. I'm getting jargony. I apologize.
Well, jargony is okay here. You can be jargony because people's eyes are rolling around in their heads, although I think this is very satisfying for people who follow this program. There's another thing that is a predictor that I've thought of as a predictor, so forgive me if I'm being sloppy here, but in women, in young women, I get, you know, parents will bring a teenager in for me. Yes, polycystic ovary disease. And I get these young women, they're either slender or they're extremely obese, their hair is greasy, their face is broken out, their androgens, their male hormones are through the roof, estrogen is spilling over to testosterone, their progesterone levels are non-existent.
This actually brings up two important points. I mean, this is really a great thing. I was going to get in PCOS. I didn't talk about polycystic ovary syndrome is the most common endocrine abnormality in premenopausal women. And it leads to changes, certainly, in more hirsutism and more male masculine appearing, and very frequently difficulties in periods and conceiving. This is a very interesting example. It's another example of many manifestations of insulin resistance where the offending tissue is actually insulin sensitive. So what's happening is your muscles are insulin resistant. You put out more insulin to overcome that insulin resistance. The ovary is sitting there, an innocent bystander, and the insulin levels makes the ovary make more male hormone. So
can you say that again?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll start again. So
the
what happens is that you have what insulin resistance really means is muscle insulin resistance. So if your muscles are resistant to insulin,
and they're not. And that means
they're not taking up the glucose.
So it's going into the blood sugar.
Well,
it's getting too high.
The body won't let it.
Right.
And so if you can do it, you secrete lots of insulin. You compensate for the insulin resistance. You prevent the glucose going up by secreting more insulin.
Mm-hmm.
So you have high blood insulin levels, which restore normal physiology to the muscle. Terrific.
And the brain, too, because the brain doesn't need insulin. No, but doesn't it need not to have too much sugar?
No.
Doesn't care.
No, brain is great
Sugar's
with sugar.
Sugar's fine.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, okay. Now, the problem is that there are other tissues in the body which recognize that insulin and do their normal thing, but since the insulin is so high, they're exaggerating the normal response. One of these is the ovary. So the high insulin, which was preventing the glucose from going up, is causing the ovary to make more male hormone, which is causing polycystic ovary syndrome.
Now, let me ask you something.
One other good example of this. The kidney is also insulin sensitive. So you can have, in the same person, have muscle resistance and normal kidney response. And that's why there's patients who are very, patients with high blood pressure who were considered to be very salt sensitive. Small amounts of salt, they retain water and blood pressure goes up. That's because the insulin is acting on the kidney to retain the salt. So those are two examples of where insulin resistance, the manifestations of syndrome X, are actually being carried out by insulin-sensitive tissues.
It.
It's a crazy
Got
idea.
It. No, it makes perfect
sense. But
the
only two tissues that are resistant are muscle and adipose tissue.
Let me just throw this in here. You talk about calcium in the book, and I just want to I always feel like I have to be very on my P's and Q's with you, except that you're so charming that I always feel a little safer. No,
well,
you're being charming to me. Okay, I'll be careful.
About people who
here, I'm going to skate out here
yeah,
a little bit.
You, right.
Okay, so, yeah, this is usually the best way to get in. Calcium, but my impression is that, because I've interviewed a lot of biochemists who specialize, and who are clinicians in micronutrients, is that calcium, of course, needs to be balanced with magnesium. You've got, right? And then you've got potassium, which helps with fluid balance, and that if you begin to supplement...
Sodium, not potassium.
Sodium and potassium. But sodium and potassium regulate. You've got me flummoxed because I'm so over my head here. Yeah. So sodium and potassium balance each other, you know, help the inner outer, you know, fluid balance on the cells, the sodium and the potassium, one being outside and one being
sodium,
inside.
Sodium,
potassium.
Potassium
what do
doesn't
I keep
affect
doing?
Sodium, potassium. Forget potassium. Sodium, you're right. Forget potassium.
But doesn't potassium balance sodium?
But it doesn't affect fluid movement. All that affects fluid movement in outside of cells is not is the osmolality.
Oh, I wish I had. I have to have the studies in
but
front of me.
But never mind.
I don't.
But go on. You got to go someplace.
Anyway,
else.
Minerals, multi-minerals, balance, balance. I'm just saying they need to be balanced.
Right.
Okay, that's all. Now, if it's an additional, if it's becoming higher in, if it's this testosterone response, then what happens in men when they're insulin resistant? I mean, what about Jan Muller's studies about heart? Do you know about Jan Muller's studies, the Swedish studies about the effect of testosterone on cardiovascular health?
There, I would say, first of all, I think the increases in testosterone that are occurring in women in response to the ovarian stimulation, there's two issues. First of all, the relatively minor changes in terms of, say, male testosterone levels, first of all. And it may also be, and there's a guy I think is probably right, that the ovary may also be even super sensitive to the effect of insulin. I mean, in other words, it may, but these levels are trivial compared to male levels, and the evidence in males that variations in testosterone have a fundamental effect on insulin action and lipid values, I think, is not terribly good.
Why do we see low testosterone levels or slightly below normal in diabetics, males?
Well, I think it's not that low, and it tends to be more type 1 diabetics, and I think it's more maybe that they're often nutritionally, you know, not doing very well. But the difference, it's not a low testosterone state. Males
low normal maybe.
Yeah, not even that low. Males with type with diabetes may have problems with potency, virility,
but that's because
neuropathy, not circulatory.
Oh,
probably.
It's not circulatory.
No, it's probably neuropathy, probably nervous, probably neuropathy, not
well,
circulatory.
Well, I've seen that when you increase circulation, it makes a huge difference.
Well, you can have that. There are some syndromes where that's the case, but in the diabetic, it's really a function of the diabetic neuropathy.
So it's down the road. When you start seeing that,
it's one of the
if it's caused by
complications.
Yeah, but in other words, what we're saying is that it would be in a diabetic, it would be down the road that you'd see that. If you saw something, because there's also just what happens to people when they get older and stuff. Anyway, let's not go there. You know, the joke of George Burns. Well, never mind, that's not appropriate for the air. George Burns has lots of jokes. Well, he said that having sex after 90 was like playing pool with a rope. that's another subject altogether. Okay, this is so cool. I can't stand it. All right. With the limited amount of time that I have left, your diet is not Barry Sears' diet. You don't like Barry Sears. You don't like Atkins. Is there any clinical evidence, though, that Atkins' diet is bad? Is there anything clinical to show for it? I've never been able to...
Well, it's only clinical in the sense that... And this, meaning a little physiology first, first of all, we know that having the higher LDL cholesterol, the more at risk you are for coronary heart disease. That's unequivocal. I mean, there's very good, doesn't mean every person gets it, but there's a very good, very, very good link. We also know that lowering LDL cholesterol, and there's now multiple trials showing that patients with even slightly abnormal cholesterol levels, if you lower it, you will get less coronary heart disease. I mean, that's, I think, beyond belief now, beyond argument.
Yeah, except that what if you've got somebody who has a low overall cholesterol, their HDLs are in a good range, but the LDLs are a little... It's okay, isn't it?
I didn't say anything about that.
All right, because that's... But people are listening to this, and they're going, LDLs, LDLs have to have HDLs.
No, I think if your LDL is, you know, marginal, you have a high HDL, I mean, you know, they're not even I can't even say what's marginal or not marginal.
Yeah,
I'm just simply saying that
saying.
In the world at large, the LDL cholesterol is a risk for coronary heart disease, and if it's high, you have a greater increased risk. And okay. If you lower a high level, you get less risk. The major regulator of LDL cholesterol concentration is your genes, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Cholesterol intake by itself is relatively trivial.
Exactly. That's really important for people to hear.
In fact, I just have a paper in my paper on, we did a study on postmenopausal women. I'm about to submit to the journal showing that nicely.
You trumped my card here.
Okay. But saturated fat will raise LDL cholesterol.
Okay, but raising LDL, first of all, here's where, and this is where I'm going to stammer, because you didn't like...
powerful regulator.
No, I know, but the question is raising LDL dangerous if the triglycerides... Look, you don't like saturated... You didn't say... When we talked on the air when I called into a show that you were on, you said some saturated fat is fine, and you say in your book,
yeah.
You remind people that no fat is all saturated fat. In fact, pork is 50 or 60% monounsaturated. It has a small amount of saturated fat, and it has others. So they're all mixed.
I'm not saying don't eat saturated fat.
I know you're not.
I'm simply saying that to be told eat as much fat as you want, and if you happen to have a high LDL cholesterol, you're going to increase it. There's absolutely no question about that.
So here's what we're saying then. What we're saying is that people, when they are following any kind of diet regime, it's prudent to go back periodically, check your lipid panel, see what your ratio is of HDL to LDL. If your triglycerides are low and you have a higher LDL but your HDL is still healthy and you have low triglycerides, you may be doing okay. You know, watch.
I would agree with you almost 100%.
Almost, okay.
But I'll tell you the small caveat I would have. Right. First of all, I agree that there is no doubt that, as I said before, the major regulator of your LDL is your mother and your father and your uncle, all those stuff.
And how?
If you have a low LDL, really low, really healthy LDL, and you eat all you want and you check it periodically and it's still very healthy, why the hell should you not
But the question is, even if, as we looked
at... I'm going to get the HDL story now. If you have a high LDL, let's say your LDL cholesterol is 180 milligrams per deciliter, which I would call high. And let's say you had a reasonably high HDL cholesterol, let's say it was 60.
Uh-huh.
I would say that I am uncomfortable because this ratio is not magic. I mean, it's an epidemiological thing. It's a good predictor. It's not magic. I would personally say I would recommend lowering your LDL even though your ratio ain't bad. Someone else could say, no, don't worry, the ratio's terrific, the hell with it.
Well,
I don't agree with that.
Here's my concern about using polyunsaturated fats to do that, okay? There is a body of research that I think even you will respect. You probably have seen this enormous Japanese study.
Mm-hmm.
What they're really talking about here is maintaining a healthy balance between the threes and the sixes, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Both of which are polyunsaturated fats.
Mm-hmm.
But that sometimes when people start to consume high amounts of vegetable oils, which are polyunsaturated fats, that are very high in the omega-6s, and they're not getting the fish oil, the flaxseed oil, whatever, and they're using that as their fat source, there can be an imbalance, and this imbalance, along with the fact that these fats are very vulnerable to how they're processed. You use a soft margarine in your diet in the book. And although you do talk about the dangers of trans fats and the fact that trans fats raise LDL, you are recommending, forgive me, I realize that I'm not attacking you as a person. I'm saying this is the book here, you've got the thing. This is a concern of mine, is that it's very important when you're dealing with polyunsaturated fats to make sure that they are processed very, very carefully and not overprocessed because they so easily oxidize.
I wouldn't agree.
Okay.
But I also would argue that I don't say in the book you should eat a lot of polyunsaturated fat.
No, you also say
monounsaturated fat.
And
if you look at diets, we're talking roughly 40% fat and roughly 20% is monounsaturated.
Right, and the good news is 40% fat, which I love. Okay, no, the reason I'm doing this, Jerry, is because people read these books and they don't think about what they're reading. And they go, oh, my God, this saturated fat is bad. And it looks from your book like saturated fat is bad. And it's very important to remember that all fats are a mixture of fats and that, in fact, monounsaturated fat, which you like, is in pork, for instance. So it's this, and lard, which people have used as an example of terrible stuff, is full of monounsaturated fat. So it's always a mixture. Okay, so I can't get you to. That was too easy.
Yeah.
That was way too easy.
I'm
protein.
Tricky.
Protein. Let's go to protein before we have to stop, because we have to stop soon. I have them here. I don't want to start pulling them out and shoving them under your nose. Oh, no, maybe I can here. There are studies that show that eating a protein-rich diet increases HDL and lowers LDL cholesterol. So would you agree that the dietary recommendations that you make in the book in terms of protein is going to vary according to how addicted someone is to carbohydrates, their satiety level, and whether or not they're exercising as vigorously as you ask them to do in this book?
The protein, first of all, the aim of the diets in these books is to come up with a diet that is not going to hurt anybody. That if you had a high LDL, it will not raise your LDL. If you have a high triglyceride and low HDL, it won't do that. So the effort is made, first of all, I guess that's the old
first do no harm.
Thank you.
Yeah.
First do no harm. Okay, that's the first. The second point is to try to make it as close to what the average American is eating as is possible within the constraints of a diet, which I think can hurt nobody. Whether or not one ate 15% protein or 18% protein, 20% protein, no one has any reason to believe it's that different.
You're being way too easy. I'm not getting a chance to score here. Yeah. You know, I thought I was really going to do something. All right, so we have a little bit of time left.
No, what I'm against, though, is the idea that somehow if you substitute protein for carbohydrate in some miraculous fashion, you're not going to raise insulin levels, and that's wrong because protein stimulates insulin.
If you eat too much. The other interesting thing is that what we talked about is that in a diabetic, someone who is diabetic, protein will not raise glucose levels, but it will raise insulin levels. So that's going to be different.
Which can be good.
Which can be good for diabetics.
Right.
So what we're saying here is, the diet that I like is a diet that uses vegetables as carbohydrates rather than grains. Can I have a whole, I've done several shows on why that's so. But the 40% fat, I think we're in agreement on, remembering that one advantage to saturated fat is it's a stable fat that doesn't oxidize. So it's, and to be careful with vegetable fats that they're balanced. The very important message that you have in here that I really think is wonderful is exercise, exercise, exercise. So in the remaining few minutes, tell us why that's so important for people with insulin resistance or people who are just addicted to starches and not functioning well.
Well, fundamentally, I think that the message is going out that being overweight makes you very insulin resistant, and it does contribute to it. But a lot of the study, most of the studies that have looked at the impact of being overweight have not looked at the fact that people overweight are frequently very sedentary. And what we showed many years ago was that if you even studied elderly individuals, and my definition changes year by year, but any people who...
Me too.
that are said to be so prone for diabetes, blah, 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 if they are not overweight and physically active, I mean, they are no more risk than everybody else in the world is. And then we start to look at specifically separating fitness from obesity. And we used a thing called maximal aerobic capacity, which is how much oxygen you use when you exercise, as an objective reality to try to assess degree of fitness. And we did a study in collaboration, actually, with a group with the Pima Indians we did in Palo Alto, people European ancestry. They did Pimas. And that's where we came up with this data, very unequivocal in both populations. Roughly 25% of the variability from insulin action from person to person is due to how fit. Ergo, it's obvious the only two things you can do to make yourself more insulin sensitive is if you're overweight and resistant, lose weight. And if you're overweight and resistant, or normal weight and resistant and sedentary, begin to exercise and you'll become more insulin sensitive. It's very clear.
Yeah, and you don't mention weightlifting in here, but increasing muscle mass increases insulin sensitivity.
Well, it doesn't. That's very interesting. Actually, it doesn't. It doesn't. It's a very interesting story. And there's one beautiful study, not done by me, so I can even say it's beautiful, by a group in, I think it was actually in Finland, I think, I'm not sure, where they took weightlifters, runners, and people. And what they found was that if they measured insulin-stimulated glucose uptake, the weightlifters and the muscle and the runners took up more glucose in response to giving them out of insulin than did the people who were neither. But when they corrected that per muscle mass, the weightlifter just had more muscle. It was not more insulin-sensitive muscle.
Right.
The runners...
Right.
has no more muscle than the average person, but the muscle itself, because, as I mentioned earlier, the GLUT4, et cetera, were now more insulin sensitive.
Yeah, although adding extra muscle speeds up your metabolism, you will agree that that's so. It's active tissue. It's burning fat and things like that.
Puts glucose away.
Yeah, it does. We're out of time, and would you consider coming back at some point?
Anytime.
Like to do, really? Oh, that's so great.
Well,
so,
but it's the first chance I've had. I wrote the book. I'll never do again, I don't think, to try to interact with the public. And most of the times, it's not interaction, and maybe only have 8 listeners, but at least felt that the 8 listeners may have learned something from today.
You got a lot of listeners today. Yeah. Syndrome X, Overcoming the Silent Killer That Can Give You a Heart Attack, Gerald Reaven, MD, Reaven, published by Simon & Schuster.
Can I put in one more?
Very quickly.
One more quick.
Very quickly.
If you want to learn more, there's an educational website, www.shaman.com, has talks about a lot of these things.
Shaman.com. If you missed parts of today's show and want to get copies of this in a cassette form, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-773-4727, 707-773-4727, or go to the KPFA website, kpfa.org, and follow the links to your own health and fitness to look at the tape list. Dr. Reaven's book is available all over the place and in all your usual spots. We are going to try to get him back on. Thank you, all of you who listened. And I want to let you know that next week I'll be doing a show with the author of The Frailty Myth, Colette Dowling. Learn why women may not be the weaker sex when it comes to athletic prowess. I'm Lena Berman. This has been your own Health and Fitness, produced live in the studios of listener-sponsored Free Speech Radio. May it live forever. KPFA FM, Berkeley, California. See you next week.